Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another wonderful episode of the Brooklyn Game Podcast. This is our third episode, and we are bringing back our delightful guest from the first one we ever did in the beginning of the season, voice of the Brooklyn Nets, play-by-play announcer, and recent winner of a New York Sports Emmy, which with his work making the 22-44 Nets interesting, which was nothing short of spectacular. I'm here with Ian Eagle. Good morning, Ian. How you doing?
Doing well, Devin. Very proud of the Emmy, but I got to be honest, I'm even more proud of the fact that out of three episodes of the podcast, I've appeared on two of them. So that, without doing the math, that's a very high percentage.
Your conversion rate is pretty good. It's easy to shoot a little bit.
I would lead the league in podcast percentages. There's no doubt about it.
I'm going to do an advanced analytics for Sloan next year, for the Sloan Conference, on podcast percentage, and I'm sure you're going to lead the top. I'm sure you're
going I want
to
see
Ryan
these numbers. Yeah, well, look, I've now doubled up Ryan's percentage, so yeah. I want to see these numbers reflected in my resume.
I'm just saying. I mean, half the time I spent talking to Ryan was about how he's not as good as Ian Eagle, so he understands.
That's not right on so many levels. And Ryan's a great guy and did an excellent job this season. So we're going to give him some love back.
Oh yeah, he's definitely the best. And I also decided that if you two ever combined to form a hybrid play-by-play announcer, we'd call him Ian Regal. So.
We actually we have a lab at the YES Network offices in Stamford, and they're working on a formula for that. So I don't think you're that far off. You're a guy that sees into the future.
We'll get there. Hey, man, I just have these visions, and I just make sure the YES Network can come through on them. but how are you? I mean, you said before you even get to the game, I mean, you've been traveling all over the country doing playoff games. I mean, how has that experience been for you so far?
Well, it's been great on a personal level because it's such a fun time of year if you're a basketball fan. And I know your background, my background, and the people that check out your website and listen to the podcasts, they eat, breathe, and you know what, this stuff. They love it. They consume it. So for me, it's a thrill to get to other venues and get a sense of the ambiance and the vibe in other cities. I've been an NBA fan all my life. I've been really, really lucky through the years. Even when the Nets weren't making the playoffs, I was able to do playoff games, and I've done NBA finals for the World Feed. So it's been a big part of my life for the last 18, 19 years, and this year's no different, other than the fact that I've definitely woken up a few times on a plane after taking a brief nap and definitely did not know exactly what the deal was, which city I was going to, which teams I was covering, and sometimes even what I do for a living.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it'd be like a little – I mean, because I cover the Nets all year. I mean, that's what I do. I've been a fan of the Nets my whole life, so I never have to worry about waking up and thinking, okay, what do I need to know this morning about the San Antonio Spurs and the Oklahoma City Thunder or something like that? You know, it's got to be, you know, a different world. You have to prepare constantly to really be, you know, at the top of your game.
Yeah, and the big key for me, and I think having done the NFL for so many years, it has helped me a great deal. It's about compartmentalizing and preparing ahead of time. You can't leave it for the last minute. If you know your assignment, you've got to really get on top of it immediately. So there's not a lot of unproductive time in my life. Even on the plane, I'm trying to use that time constructively, trying to do the best I can to make sure I've got every storyline covered. And obviously doing the Nets throughout the season allows you to see all these other teams around the NBA. So it's not like I'm walking in blind when I'm doing an Oklahoma City-Houston playoff game or an Indiana and Atlanta playoff game. I've seen these teams. I've been around these teams. I have relationships with people that work for those teams. So I feel like I'm a quick study, and I can get up to speed and certainly have an understanding of how to organize your thoughts and organize the different stories that are attached to the particular game that I'm covering.
Speaking of organization, or I'm actually going to go lack thereof, the Nets played the Bulls last night, and it ended in a 79-76 loss at the hands of the Bulls. which seemed a lot closer than it was for most of the game. You were as close as anybody that day. You were, you know, doing play-by-play. You were covering the game. What did you see in those last few minutes, you know, that kind of that pretty much decided the outcome?
Well, obviously the hole was so deep and the Nets had played so poorly, shot the ball so poorly that it was tough for them to climb out of it. What you did see in that fourth quarter, at the very least, was something to build on heading into game four. The reality for the Nets, I think throughout the season, you play the regular season to figure out what your identity is. And when you have a strong sense of what that is, normally those teams can go into the postseason and have success. Amidst this 49-win season, this huge turnaround, this big change in everything, literally for this franchise, new home, new colors, new logo, new name, new players, new head coach, I'm still not sure they have a full understanding of what their identity is. They're still trying to figure that out. And here we are now getting ready for game four of the first round of the playoffs, and it's going to have to happen very soon. The postseason in the NBA will reveal weaknesses. It will also show you your strengths. And Chicago knows that they're a mentally stable team. They've dealt with adversity throughout the season. They're looking to make the game ugly. They weren't able to do that in game one. The Nets just put a stamp on that game right out of the gate. Game two, played to Chicago style. Game three opened well for the Nets. And then at that six-minute mark, it just went downhill, and it carried over into the second quarter, into the third quarter. And finally, they were able to snap out of it in the fourth quarter, got some stops, turned those into easy baskets. To me, which was a huge theme, not only in this game but in this series, when you're playing against a defensive-minded team, Devin, got to get shots off earlier in the shot clock, try to extend possessions, try to multiply possessions. The more possessions you get against a really good defensive team, just go with the law of averages, the higher the chances for you to go out and put points on the board. Chicago's not a team that's just going to go out and outscore you. They just won't do it. It's not who they are. They've been able to develop the blueprint in game two and game three, and now here in getting ready for game four basically is your series. We're either going to find out if the Nets are mentally tough, if they avoid that fragile tag, or if Chicago has really put their fingerprints all over this series and take a 3-1 lead, looking to wrap things up going back to Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, if that, I really do think game four, I mean, there's a decision to be made here. I mean, as far as just if the Nets are going to have a shot at getting into the second round, but if they lose another one, I mean, if they can't take home court advantage back, there's going to be, you know, there's a good chance we're not going to see them beyond game five. And I wanted to ask you about that because one of the things you were talking about was to say, you know, they are a grinded out team. You know, they've scored 89, 90, and 79 points in three games, the Bulls, that is.
Yeah.
And that's just, even if you're playing at slow pace, it's just that's what they do. And I don't know if the Nets have been able to do that so much, but they do have these grinded out players in their lineup. They've got, you know, Gerald Wallace and Reggie Evans, those guys who kind of play to that. But it doesn't seem like they're playing at the same level that necessarily Chicago is right now. So I guess my question is, do you think that, you know, PJ or the Nets need to make an adjustment to the lineups in the next couple of games to turn this around, or is it just a matter of motivation?
Yeah, I don't have any issue with the team going with the same starting five. It was a successful group. But if you recognize early that the Bulls are allowing Evans and Wallace to roam free on offense and they can't take advantage of it, well, clearly you can't play 3-on-5 against an excellent defensive team. And that did stand out in game three. The problem for the Nets is they never really developed a stringent rotation where you know exactly where they're going to turn next. Keith Bogans was a big part of it throughout the year. Bogans didn't participate in game three, coach's decision. Marshawn Brooks, you're asking a great deal of him confidence-wise now to step in and make things happen. I'm sure there was nervousness when he came out on the floor. Nets were down. They did make that run. Brooks was part of that unit, but whether or not he can be right in the middle of it, of a team that now gets back into a series, I don't know. I mean, that's asking a lot. Obviously, the coaching staff's going to take a step back and try to get a feel for which players and which positions are going to make the most sense. But this bench that had played such a big role over the course of the season is now really a non-factor. Andre Blatch looked limited in game three. Blatch was at his best when he's playing with Lopez, not when he's got to anchor the middle on his own. Jerry Stackhouse continues to struggle in this postseason series. In game one, it didn't really matter because the Nets were so good. But now, if you look at the totality of the series, Stackhouse just has not been able to make a play. You know, and the other part too, Devin, and I think if you really go man for man on this squad, the natural leaders on this team are probably not guys that can go out and lead right now because they're not doing enough on the court to be able to really play that leadership role, and that would be Wallace and Stackhouse and Bogans. I think those are the guys that other players would listen to, but they've got to be major contributors in order to get that message across. So there seems to be a void right now, especially when this team faces adversity. And this game four is really going to be a telltale sign of which direction this team is headed in. There were times during the season where the Nets were very difficult to figure out, and they did rise to the occasion during points of the season. Following that San Antonio loss, the blowout loss on New Year's Eve, I think a lot of us thought this Nets team was headed for a very, very difficult road, and they bounced right back with that win in Oklahoma City, probably their signature win of the year. We're looking at a similar situation now with Brooklyn, where they've got to dig a little deeper, and we're going to find out what this team is all about. I think this game four is going to be very revealing.
I absolutely agree. I think that this is the time. Game one was probably the most important game of the season as a starter, and then game two became the most important game of the season, and now it's game four. It's just
sure.
One of those points where they're going to figure out, you know, if they can play for a cohesive unit for 48 minutes, figure out their rotations. The fact that Bogans didn't play in game three, it's frankly a little stunning to me. Both as someone who thinks that he's very effective off the bench, but also just he's been a part of the rotation all season. And it's just like very
strange. Yes. Yeah, and Devin,
start off the bench.
He brings an edge. I mean, there is something about him when he takes the floor now. He's not shot the ball well in recent weeks. That's been well chronicled. He's basically a three-point shooter right now. He's not a guy that can put the ball on the floor and make things happen going to the rim. I think PJ felt that Stackhouse still has the ability to break down his defender and create, maybe even draw a double team. Keith is not going to draw a double team right now. So that probably had to do with a lot of the thinking in Game 3. But guess what? Adjustments are going to have to be made. I think why Tom Thibodeau gets a great deal of credit in the way he handles his team, the way he coaches his team, it's similar in a way to Bill Belichick. Everything you hear about Bill Belichick, and I've been really fortunate to interview Bill through the years. I got to know him when he was an assistant with the New York Jets, and obviously his success has been at a Hall of Fame level with the New England Patriots. Bill will game plan for an entire week, prepare his team. And if something is not working and it's glaring in the first half of a game, guess what? He will take his team to the sideline, and he'll make adjustments. He'll draw it up in the sand, so to speak, or in the dirt, and show them, hey, I know we talked about doing this, but now we're going to do that. Tom Thibodeau is that kind of guy. He will adjust on the fly. And there aren't a lot of guys that do that in the NBA. I think most NBA coaches stick with what they know and what the feelings and opinions were going into the game. And then they use the off days to make their changes and make their adjustments and alterations. This is a huge, huge day in between game three and game four for PJ in terms of getting his lineup straight, in terms of getting everybody on the same page, and also with his coaching staff getting a feel for which substitutions will fit. Look, that second foul on Brook Lopez, to me, was a game changer because the Nets were headed south to begin with. And at that point, when Lopez went to the bench during that long drought, they just didn't have someone to bail them out, to get them a bucket, to end the Chicago run, to quell some of the crowd. And it snowballed. And unfortunately, the Nets never recovered.
I'm going to change tack a little bit. I'm going to talk about something a little more long-term. There was a report yesterday that the Nets are working on finalizing a multi-year extension with general manager Billy King. You know, this comes on the heels of the idea that maybe Phil Jackson would join the team's front office. You know, Billy within the last year of a contract. What are your thoughts so far on the job that Billy has done as a general manager, and you know what this extension could mean for Brooklyn going forward?
Well, this team was 22-44 last season. They were 12th in the Eastern Conference. Billy King made as many moves as any other GM in the NBA during the offseason. Since that point, I think we've seen Houston probably make more moves than any other team, and they've changed their roster around entirely. But in the offseason, when the Nets' edict was, we've got to make changes with the idea that the team is headed to Brooklyn, Billy King made those changes, and he made some bold moves, as we know, and remade this roster entirely. I think at that point, he did build confidence with Mikhail Prokhorov and his people that Billy's vision was the right vision for a quick turnaround of this team and trying to build something. I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that Billy would get an extension. You know, I think Billy has been a steadying force and a rock in that front office. He's been bold, which I think you have to be in the NBA. And you look towards the future. This is the team they're going to have, other than some draft picks here and there, some possible deals, smaller deals. Ultimately, the core of Joe Johnson, Deron Williams, and Brook Lopez will be there. The questions are obviously going to pop up depending upon how this team does in the postseason about a head coach. Does P.J. Carlesimo show enough to maintain his job, or does the combination of ownership and Billy King, the general manager, decide that they need a new voice and they need somebody new directing this team on a day-to-day basis? Those are the questions that are going to pop up. Obviously, this series will play a big deciding factor in that. If the Nets go on to play Miami, how they perform against Miami would also play a role in that. But, Devin, I'm not surprised that Billy is going to be re-upped and that he and Mikhail Prokhorov have seen eye-to-eye on the future and the vision of this team.
And it's hard to see eye-to-eye with Mikhail Prokhorov. That man is very...
He's a big guy.
Yeah.
Very, very tall guy. You know, some people think, oh, I don't know, maybe he just shows up that way in pictures and video. No. He towers over you, Devin, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, that's true. For the readers who have never seen me in person, I'm 6'5", and he towers. He does tower. And he can't play basketball very well either, which is kind of surprising, you know?
He's the owner
of a basketball team.
I wouldn't say that. Yeah,
really?
I wouldn't say that. Yeah, maybe you would say that, but I would say he's a fine player. From what I've seen on video, he looks to me like a very talented player, in fact.
I just realized I insulted a 6'9 Russian billionaire oligarch. So, no, he's a great basketball player.
Thank you. There you go. Much better. Much better.
You did talk about this a little bit, but I kind of want to expand on it because I'm curious. Do you think that this series is an ultimatum on PJ as a coach? Do you think that they have to win this series for him to come back next year? Or do you think there's other possibilities that could occur whereas they find PJ as a coach again next year?
Well, I think this series is going to be a big part of the overall equation because, let's face it, you're judged by what you do in the postseason. In this league, that's just how it works. Fair, unfair, ultimately, that's always going to be a big factor in how you're seen, how you're viewed, what your persona is, your legacy is. What you do in the playoffs is what it's all about. So I know PJ is aware of that. I think, you know, PJ is just trying to do what he needs to do in order to lead this team through this series. I don't think PJ is focused on whether or not he's going to keep his job. He's been doing this long enough. He's been at this a really long time on a number of different levels. And I know him well enough to know that that's what his every waking moment is dealing with right now, trying to get the Nets out of this first round and a series win over the Chicago Bulls. The other stuff, which we know is real life, keeping your job, affecting your family, affecting your assistant coaches, you know, there's a domino effect that comes with that. That's going to be for another time. But for now, I think his focus is on game four and coming up with a game plan to deal with the Bulls and their style of play, which is go hard every single possession. That's the one thing you knew coming into this series. We talked about the possibility of playing the Hawks or playing the Bulls. To me, this was going to be a real playoff atmosphere. This was going to be what you think the postseason is supposed to be like, going on the road, tough environment, a team that tests you every step of the way. I know that there were some that thought, oh, Atlanta's a much easier matchup, rather go with that. Well, in my mind, you want to see where your team's at. If you're going to play Miami in the next round anyway, you might as well get tested to the ultimate degree in the opening round to see how you handle it. Pressure situations, tough venue in Chicago. The Nets-Atlanta series, the potential there, it would have been a completely different kind of series. Not to say that Nets would have been a guarantee to win that series or Atlanta would have shown up and their style would have been too much, the up and down for the Nets to handle. Look, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. It didn't work out that way. But I never felt like that was going to feel like the playoffs compared to this. And I think this franchise needed that experience. And obviously, you want to get that experience and win so you can learn from it. But at the very least, this is what you prepared for. Tough game four, down 2-1 against a team where there are no secrets. This is what they do. This is how they play. There's no way Chicago can change who they are because this is it. It's permanent right now with this group.
It's definitely going to be an interesting game four, and I know I will be watching. And I know, are you commentating on that game? I don't even know, to be honest. Will you be on game four?
Yeah. I'm in Chicago. It's game four on My Nine on Saturday afternoon.
I know a lot of people will be watching. I'm going to hit you with a few rapid-fire-esque questions before I let you go, because there's a few things I've always wanted to ask you. As a renowned traveler, what's your favorite city to eat in on the road?
Oh, favorite city to eat in on the road. I would tell you originally when I came into the NBA it would be San Antonio. Just love the Mexican food down there, love the Riverwalk. And then I was there for an extended period of time, and I ate too much of it. And it turned me off for a while. So I'm trying to get back to that place, that initial love, that first love that I had for San Antonio. But that was number one for a while.
It sounds like you're that's a very sad story. Actually, you've lost love.
No, it's actually a fairly sad story because I love fajitas. There's no getting around. I like to say the word fajita, and I like to eat them. So what better place to go to in the 48 contiguous states but Texas and San Antonio, where they have excellent fajitas. But, I had a bad experience, and it threw me off. I mean, that would be a much different podcast if you wanted to go deeper into that story, but I'd rather not.
You know, yeah, maybe we'll save that for my latest food depressing stories podcast on my new Tumblr account that I'm creating right now. if you've been commentating in the NBA for a long time, what would you say is the thing that's most starkly different from when you started in the early 90s about the NBA?
I think early 90s during the Jordan years, It was still about the glitz and glamour, and I think it was growing internationally. The foothold it now has as a world sport, there's no question that happened a long time ago. I think what's probably happened more with the NBA than any other sport is there's a fan base that's expanded, and I think now because of the fact that NBA League Pass has become such a must for the NBA fan, the knowledge base is so much more than it used to be. So I feel like, you know, fans in Arizona could have a better handle on the Brooklyn Nets than they ever did, and vice versa. You know, fans in Staten Island that are huge fans of the Memphis Grizzlies can know everything they need to know about their team. So it's part and parcel with the information age, with social media. There's just so much more info out there. And for a play-by-play guy, it's really a blessing and a curse. For me, I've looked at it as a blessing, which is more information means more chances at good stories, good nuggets, more insight. The curse, if you want to look at it that way, is it's constant. It's every day, and your knowledge has to be at a higher level based on the fact that the fan's knowledge is at a higher level. For a guy like me who likes to prepare, I like what goes into the preparation in these games and digging out facts and trying to go a little deeper to find something that hasn't actually gotten a whole lot of airtime. It's a challenge now because your viewers know so much more than they used to know, and it changes the way you do your job.
Do you get called out by viewers? Do people say to you? I mean, obviously, people are always going to their internet commenters rule the world these days in that kind of way. But do people actually say to you? Do you have to deal with viewers like that who will, I don't know, email you or find you and say, "Hey, this is a dumb thing you said," and you have to, like, is that something that's changed? Is that something that happens more now?
No, I mean, I'm sure it happens more now. You know, we've talked about this. I'm not on Twitter, so I'm not instantly available like other guys are, and that probably is a part of it. You know, for me to do my job and to do my job well, I really believe I've got the viewers in mind. I do this with the viewers and listeners for radio being number one. That's my number one priority. That will always be the case. If you allow yourself minute by minute to be affected what's going on in each individual viewer's mind, you may not be thinking about the big picture, which is trying to satisfy everybody. So, no, I'm not immediately available, and that's probably part of the reason for me to do my job and do it well. If you get caught up in the minutia minute by minute, it will affect your on-air performance. I think viewers have a means in which to share their opinions more than ever before with Twitter and with Facebook and other social media sites, which is a great thing. More banter is better in terms of getting ideas out there and sparking new ideas. But you have to do it constructively if you're on my side of the equation. You've got to know that not everything works for television. Just because something may work in a Twitter conversation doesn't mean it's going to play well on TV. So I trust my instincts in picking and choosing those moments. Also trust my instincts in bringing levity onto the air. If something strikes me as comical or funny, I tend to go with it on the air. But that's not something that I could do in year one, year two, year three, year four, year five, because you have to build up a credibility and you have to build up a trust with your audience.
All right, so next question. Finish this sentence. If I, Ian Eagle, was not a play-by-play commentator for a profession, I would be? I just hurt you, didn't I?
Yeah, you hurt me. Because now I've got to go deep into the recesses of my brain. What if all of my dreams had crumbled very early coming out of Syracuse in 1990? What would have happened? What path would I have taken? To be honest, I still think I would have been involved in sports in some way. I just grew up as a sports nut. I always thought there would be something performance related in my life. My parents were entertainers. My dad was a stand-up comedian, an actor, a musician. My mom was a singer, an actress. So I never saw a 9-to-5 job for myself. I saw myself doing something that was maybe a little off the beaten path. I was encouraged to do so by my parents. So to nail it down, I don't know. I think I would have ended up somewhere where I combined sports and some kind of performance if possible.
So you'd be a
sports performer, I think. Maybe I would have been a halftime performer at NBA games in some.
You could have been Red Panda, Ian Eagle, the new Red Panda.
I'd be okay with that. I mean, if that's where life took me, I think I would have been proud of that. I could have looked my kids in the eye, and they would have had to accept me for who I was.
I'm sure they do just fine now. Okay, so one last question before I let you go. What is the thing you hate most about Mike Fratello?
I don't hate anything about Mike. Mike is one of my best friends. Mike is very needy, though. If for those who don't know him, he requires constant maintenance, phone calls, check-ins. He's got like 6 phones. So just because he calls you or you call him doesn't mean you have his full attention. I mean, honestly, I've been in the car with him where he's working it with multiple phones, and he's on the phone with one guy. Hey, Tony, how you doing? Yeah, are you going to be there? Well, hold on. I got Vic on the other line. Vic, no, I'm talking to Tony. Wait, no, are you meeting him? Tony, are you meeting Vic there? What, Vic? Hold on. Wait, Louise, what's going on with you? I'm like, what are you doing? He just needs to have constant attention. I've learned that about him. But once you give him that, he's very easy to be around. And he actually has a big heart. He's one of the nicest guys I've ever worked with. And we hit it off really early. And on the air, I feel like the chemistry has been there from day one.
Yeah, you guys really do have an awesome – if somebody listens to you guys when you guys are on the road, because I don't travel outside of the region, always good to hear when Ian and Mike are on it. If only because of those halftime – I mean, the asking announcers, the schedule,
yeah.
his drawing ability, which I thought you were going to say his artistic ability was what
– Yeah. He had no idea. The funniest part, Devin, is – you know, I found it very comical that he would do these drawings and he would take – time out of his day. I'm not joking here. Let's say, you know, you're staying at a Marriott. He would then bring the pad from the Marriott that he had doodled on to do the drawings first and then look at those drawings and do them on the schedule. So I noticed this very early in our tenure. So I was like, oh my gosh, this guy is really putting in a lot of time for these drawings. And I thought to myself, the funniest thing would be if I just guess things that have no connection whatsoever to his drawings. So I figured he would kind of, you know, after the second or third time that I said an amoeba or a lima bean, that he would figure out that I was just saying random things at that point. He never figured it out. We had gone a good solid 2 years, and one day during a break after one of those segments, he turned to me and said, "Man, you're really bad at this." And I realized that he has no idea that I'm just making up random objects. So I said, I got to just stick with this thing and ride it as long as we possibly can. And I think finally in year 3 he says, you're not really guessing, are you? I go, no, I'm not guessing. It took a good solid 2.5 years for him to figure out that, that I just would bark out random things in life.
Well, when you said, because you said the word before it came to mind, when you said sizzling hot fajitas when they were calling on the Rockets, they really did look like sizzling hot fajitas.
Yeah, I do. You know what? I almost treat it as if it's a visit to a psychiatrist's office, because it's a drawing of some sort, and you're basically saying, what's the first thing that comes to mind? And I really do react that way. I don't have any planned things that I'm going to say ahead of time. I really look at his drawings, and I treat it like I'm meeting with some deep psychotherapist to figure out what's the first thing that comes to mind. I don't really have a whole lot of experience with that, Devin. I want to get that on the record. But as I would imagine it would be to sit down and look at random drawings and tell you the first thing that comes to mind. Truth be told, I'm really lucky having – you know, worked with Mike all these years now. Jim Spinarkle and I have worked together for 19 years, college and pro, and Jim is one of my best friends in the world and just a great partner. Greg Anthony came on board this year. He did 20 games, and we really hit it off as well. So there's a lot of trust that goes into this. I've always looked at it as a team. I don't look at it as two individuals, no matter who I work with, NBA, NFL, college basketball, tennis, golf, whatever it might be. If you're going to share that airtime together, to me, it's a collaborative process, and I really do the best that I can to try to bring out the best in the person that I'm working with.
And I think you do, except when you're on a podcast with me, because I bombed this. I didn't really pay attention.
Yeah, this is not collaborative. These are two individuals.
Yeah, just completely separate. But I'm very glad to hear that you have a twice-a-week Rorschach test with Mike Fratello. I didn't realize that until just now. That's very good. And that's about the time we got here. Is there anything else you want to say about the Nets series, yourself, your family, your hopes and dreams before we sign off?
No, I think we covered it all. I feel like I owe you something for this session. I got a lot off my chest here, Devin. Thank you.
That's all right. Hey, you know, just keep commentating on Nets games. I think we'll be fine.
Thanks. I know the fans live and die with every possession, especially in the postseason. Oftentimes in the playoffs, there's a lot of strong opinions after every game, and those opinions can fluctuate based on the result in the game. This game four, to me, is really interesting, and I'm as curious as everybody else to see how the Nets handle their business and if they show some fortitude on the road. They're certainly capable of it. We saw that during the regular season. This team did play extremely well on the road under some tough conditions, and you know, this one is by far the biggest challenge. Chicago, you know what they're going to bring to the table. They're going to play hard. They're not going to give you the game. The Nets are going to have to go out there and get it. Adjustments are definitely going to have to be made. And I think the biggest one is probably going to come with that lineup. And it's going to come off feel with Gerald Wallace and Reggie Evans. If those two aren't able to help you offensively, you can't dig yourself that deep a hole and expect to get out of it once again on the road.
And I mean, I know I'll be watching. I'm sure a lot of people will be watching you or listening to you while you watch the game. Saturday, 2:00, game four, Nets Bulls. And I just want to say thank you again, Ian, for coming on. This has been awesome. It's always great to talk to you. And you know, enjoy the rest of the playoffs, however far you go. And thanks again.
All right, Devin, great to talk to you. Keep up the outstanding work. The site has been awesome this year. It's really a terrific resource for me, game in and game out, when I'm preparing. So I know Nets fans have really enjoyed your work throughout the season.
Much appreciated, Ian. And that is it for the Brooklyn Game Podcast, Episode 3. Are you have something else you want to say, Ian? I think I cut you off there.
No, I just assume that Episode 4, my percentage rate will go to 75%.
We'll see. I might have to get Spinarco in there. He might get jealous. So we'll see how it goes.
He's always jealous.
Thanks again, Ian, and thank you again for if you've been listening this far, thank you so much for listening. And you know, the BrooklynGame.com will be there for all of your Nets news and analysis. Take care, Ian.
All right, see you, Depp.